Welcome to the 22nd episode of Reverse Threat Radio. I'm Andy Ryan.
And I'm David Chad.
And on a sad day for cricket, we'll be looking forward to the future.
So today in London, Mohammad Asif and Salman Butt have been convicted of their various spot-fixing charges, and we found out that Mohammad Amir in fact pleaded guilty before the whole thing kicked off. But across on the other side of the world, it's been rather nice to see their teammates sort of carrying on regardless, in a sense, and closing out victory against the Sri Lankans with a certain ruthlessness that we haven't really seen from Pakistan recently. I was slightly worried when Sri Lanka in their second innings threatened to do what they've done quite a lot both against Sri Lanka and during the series, which is actually produce the batting goods in the second innings. And
Sangakkara has been really impressive, hasn't he?
Sangakkara has been impressive, and when he was looking good and Sri Lanka are 80 for one, you thought sort of this is going to be another bore draw. But in fact, Pakistan came through strongly. The youngster Khan continues to look threatening. Syed Ajmal finished the deal, and Hafiz came out with a pretty ruthless batting display.
Just a shame that this sort of new, young, resilient Pakistani side couldn't have completed this win in front of a packed house in Karachi.
It was exactly. But there was one of the other things that's been very exciting this week is the way that the scenes in Bulawayo, as Zimbabwe,
where there certainly was a packed house, and they were jumping for joy after they saw Zimbabwe chase down 329 to stun New Zealand in that third ODI.
Well, just not stun, not just New Zealand, but just the whole of the
cricket
world.
Frankly, everyone, yeah. I mean, Brendan Taylor's been brilliant for Zimbabwe recently. Back-to-back hundreds in this series and got the chase off to a great start with a rapid-fire 75. But when he goes, you assume it was it. And then Malcolm Waller played this quite brilliant 99 off 74 balls, keeping it all together when lots of other Zimbabweans were desperately losing the plot at the other end. But yeah, it was the fact that there were so many Zimbabweans there just enjoying seeing their side back in international cricket again.
Exactly.
What's been disappointing? If Pakistan have got you excited, what's been letting you down this week?
Well, I was rather looking forward to Australia setting off to South Africa and being roundly thrashed. I always enjoy the sight of the Australians being roundly thrashed. But of course, that hasn't really happened in the limited overs matches. The tests are yet to come. But if there's one team that's going to be carrying momentum forward to the tests, then it is surely the Australians. And I think the root of the South Africans' inability to overcome the Australians has been the fact that their middle order, their batting middle order, which has promised so much, the sort of Callis, de Villiers, Dumini, both a Morkel even lineup, it's promised so much, but it looked positively English in its complete lack of ruthlessness, its complete lack of ability to build an innings, to structure an innings.
And they needed the tail enders to drag them out of trouble in the T20, didn't they?
Exactly, it was a very impressive the partnership at 8 and 9, a 64-run partnership. But throughout, you just get the sense that the South African middle order weren't going to assert themselves on the game, whether in chasing a total or from when batting first and setting a total.
My disappointment over the last fortnight's actually come not from a team, but actually from England's fans and English journalists. I think this was obviously a very disappointing one-day series. To lose 5-0 is always going to be very disappointing. But I just felt the criticism was ludicrously excessive. England have been superb this summer. They've had as good a summer as any international side have had for a very long time. And they kept up a level of performance this summer that was just consistently impressive.
I suppose the problem is balancing the high standards that were set over the summer with the thrashing of the Indian side with just this feeling that we've sort of seen it all before with the one-day side. That going to the subcontinent and playing against spin on the subcontinent in one-day cricket, England just aren't performing. And so I wonder whether there's a little bit of justification, actually.
I think this inability to play one-day cricket on the subcontinent, it continues to be an issue. I just felt there seemed to be a kind of a mass amnesia. We seem to forget that we're dealing with a side that's been outstanding, not just actually of the summer, but even going back to the Ashes. And we almost just needed to cut them a little bit of slack. I mean, a lot of these guys are just very good cricketers, part of a good team, who just had a difficult series. And perhaps we need to be a little bit more understanding on occasion.
And so I suppose in some ways we've seen the cricketing world turned on its head this week with the Pakistani cricketers convicted in London, their teammates winning against Sri Lanka against the odds, England losing against India against the odds, Australia winning series against South Africa against the odds, and then the West Indies on top in a test match. We don't know at the moment how that's going to finish, but you know,
see if they finish
it might be against Bangladesh, but there's something happening. Something happening.
From the archives, in this episode, Toby is going to tell us how a catering company brought commercial cricket to Australia.
It's a fascinating and slightly unusual tale. We have to rewind back to 1851, when an Englishman by the name of Felix William Spears set off to Australia as part of the Gold Rush. And when he was out there in Melbourne, he met one Christopher Pond, who was the son of a customs officer. And they got together and they set up Spears and Pond.
It's a name out of Dickens, isn't it? It's great.
Well, it's funny you should mention Dickens. Did you actually do that deliberately, or did you know the Dickensian...
I didn't know. I'll own up. That was not deliberate. No.
So, Spears and Pond set up a catering company in a hotel in Melbourne. And this goes very well. And they set up a room called the Shakespeare Grill Room. And then they buy another cafe called the Café de Paris, a little bit more exotic. But they decide they want to shoot for the stars. They want to go big. And so they decide to get the European sensation that is none other than Charles Dickens to come over. Come over and do a book tour. Charles Dickens, he was doing book tours all over the UK and Europe at the time. Dickens doesn't much fancy the long journey out, and so they're left with a problem on their hands. What can they possibly do that's going to draw the crowds as much as Charles Dickens would have done? And so what they decide to do is they decide to get an all-England cricket touring side to come over. And it's the first ever cricket side that is paid to come over from England to Australia. So they select this side, which is mostly made up of Surrey players, and these people come over in 1861-2. They play 12 matches, 6 of which they win, 2 of which they lose, and 4 of which are drawn. And one of them includes what I think was, we've talked a bit on this podcast about sort of World 11 matches, and one of them is branded the World 11 against the Surrey 11, which isn't quite as impressive.
Seems a bit of a mismatch,
doesn't it? Which is actually won by the World 11 in the end, mostly courtesy of one George Bennett, who scores 72 runs altogether and then takes 14 wickets for 115. So you sense a little bit of dominance there. So this is actually the first moment that commercial cricket is brought to Australia, and the legacy is huge in two very important ways. One of which, the legacy for the catering industry is perhaps more significant than the legacy for the cricketing industry, because Spears and Pond, when they give up in Australia, they go back to London and they are mooching around in London, eating at kind of station cafes and underground stations in London, as you do. And they decide that it's so bad that they decide that they have to dedicate the rest of their lives to revolutionising underground railway station cafes in London. So there's a legacy for the catering industry. The other one is that this really does set up the tradition of English and Australian sides touring to one another. And in fact, the next year, in 1863, Melbourne Cricket Club invites another team back, another All England team back, and that sort of link is set up.
I mean, the fascinating thing is that the basis for this is promotion, isn't it? It's the cricket
is
just a means to an end.
Cricket was used to market.
Did they feel it was
Pond
a success? I mean, did they feel that this stunt worked?
I think so, because cricket was quite popular in Australia at the time, but it had never been seen on that kind of commercial basis. And certainly, I mean, the evidence is that this was, I mean, cricket was part of a kind of wider mix of promotional opportunities. So Spears and Pond also put on the first ever hot air balloon ride in Australia. So you very much, I mean, cricket is being used as a means to an end.
But also the cricketers themselves are winning from this as well. I mean, for these Surrey cricketers, they were presumably but fairly well paid.
Paid £150, which back then was a hell of a lot of money, actually.
So for them, I mean, at a time when the sport was sort of broadly still, you know, amateurism was very strong within it. You know, this was a genuine once in a lifetime opportunity.
So so nowadays, obviously, we lament the influence of commercialism on cricket, but here we see it actually having a massive sort of formative impact on
the relationship is kind of quite symbiotic, isn't it? The two are helping each other out. I mean, cricket's being moved forward, and sort of the catering industry is obviously getting something out of it.
which we all like to see,
everyone's a winner. I mean, do you think it's interesting that, I mean, I had never heard about this before you raised it and did some, you know, groundbreaking research into this subject. You know,
well, this is the interesting thing, because I don't think it's entirely entirely groundbreaking. I am slightly sad in the number of old cricket books I read, which is why I sort of picked up on it. But it's certainly not. It's certainly not well known, and I think it is actually a pretty important moment in the. Well, when you think that a chap called John Conway, who was playing for the World 11 in that World against Surrey 11 match we were talking about, actually went on to be the first Australian captain to take an Australian side to tour England, and so it really is the beginning. I mean, it's the thing that, yes, inevitably, Australia would have played cricket professionally and Australia would have toured England and England would have toured Australia. But this really was the catalyst that set the whole thing up.
Do you think perhaps, though, there might be a slight reluctance on cricket's part to almost admit it has a certain debt to these entrepreneurs? You could even say the Lalit Modis of their day.
So little do we acknowledge that actually the history of catering and the history of cricket are so closely bound up. So, to the book review, and this episode we're looking at Simon Hughes's A Lot of Hard Yakka. Simon Hughes, who we know more recently from his work as the analyst with Channel 4, Channel 5, whichever terrestrial TV channel the cricket has happened to be shunted onto.
But this was the book that really made his name. And it's interesting because I think you can really class cricket autobiographies into the kind of, there's the more old school model of cricket as a hero, this is a really wonderful, glorious pursuit.
We've seen that with Leary Constantine last episode with his Cricket and the Sun.
Exactly, and it's tales of great players and their exploits, basically. This falls into the more modern category that I'd describe as the kind of warts and all autobiography.
So it was published in 1997 and tells the tale, really, of the Middlesex dressing room. And I mean, it is mainly set in the dressing room rather than anything else, during the 1980s. And certainly there are lots of amusing anecdotes about players who, you know, we have a stereotype about Gassing, which is that he ate all the pies, and about Brearley, and that, you know, he wasn't a very good cricketer and just spent his time man managing. But what this does is it fleshes out all of that out with actually, I mean, it's incredibly readable, and mostly because it's just absolutely packed with this warts and all description.
It's interesting because I suppose any workplace you have this conflict between different characters, but perhaps the atmosphere of a cricket dressing room is such that all those conflicts kind of push very close together. And in that sense, the book is kind of part sort of soap opera. I mean, in terms of what it says about cricket, perhaps one of the most staggering things it would say to a modern cricket fan is just you can't believe how amateurish things are. Mm. I mean, we're talking about the 80s, the early 90s. We're not talking about, you know, half a century ago, and yet the game is almost unrecognisable. We hear about pre-season training where most of the players just lark about, no one's
really
taking it seriously.
And net sessions where the trick is basically how you can avoid having to do any work whatsoever. I mean, there are also this ritual of at 10:30 before any game. You know, no one would really have done any warm-up, but everyone just sat in the dressing room just eating large amounts of anything that they could possibly find.
Eating is kind of the key activity, isn't it? I mean, particularly for Gatting, we hear about his pre-match bacon sandwich. And you kind of think Andy Flower or someone now, the game's changed almost beyond recognition.
I mean, the idea of a conditioning coach to that Middlesex dressing room would have just been absolute anathema. But it's not only the sort of the county players who are shown off as being slightly amateurish. It's actually the sort of the management as well. There's a great anecdote about the TCCB, the English Cricket Board as was, using the Duke's ball, which has a very pronounced seam, and everyone and hundreds of wickets. Sorry, the Reader's ball with a very pronounced seam and loads of wickets are taken and lots of bowlers average under 20. And so the authorities get a bit worried about this and they decide to hold what they, you know, term as some kind of strict examination and sort of scientific analysis of the thing, which involves them coming and watching Simon Hughes and a couple of others bowl to Mark Nicholas, another great pundit who we know from TV, unfortunately, nowadays. Bowl to Mark Nicholas in the nets, who Simon Hughes says is a completely crap batsman, so they can't get a bat on ball anyway. And so this is how they decide to change. This is how they
Hardly
decide what
scientific.
Ball is going to use by just turning up to the nets and watching for a little bit, and that's the only way that it happens.
I mean, it's interesting as well because there's a lot of actual sort of sadness, I think, in the book as well. I mean, Simon Hughes, when he breaks into the Middlesex side, when he gets his first contract, he goes up with three other players, some of whom he's known, I think, going up the age grade. And within a very short time, Hughes achieves quite a bit of success. He gets a championship winner's medal, he plays, he's regularly in the side. And it's pretty sad to see that certainly two of the four, I think Rajesh Maru does build some sort of a career, really, certainly at Hampshire, I think, later on. Certainly two of the four really just kind of drift away.
Yep.
And it's extraordinary, really, because you see them enter the game as players who were seen as kind of comparable talents. And within months, you know, a little bit of luck here, a little bit of bad luck there. And suddenly their fortunes are totally diverged.
There's a very sort of poignant paragraph when he's saying that he goes, I think he's playing at Warwickshire. And it's the day that a lot of the players there have been told whether they're going to have their contracts renewed. And he goes to the pub with them afterwards. And he comments just that these people, since the age of 17, have given their entire life to cricket. And suddenly they're put out into the world, and cricket isn't a career option for them. And they have absolutely nothing to do. Mm. And he actually says that there's one summer where he's a couple of weeks before having his 3-year contract renewed, and so he's not sure what the future's going to hold. And he says very honestly, I just don't know whether I'm going to be stacking shelves this time.
That's why we sometimes kind of glorify this amateurism within the game. So things like, you think, oh, wasn't it such a laugh? You know, things like them turning up and having a bacon sarnie and messing around. But it had a very cruel side as well in terms of how the players were treated. I mean, there are a couple of horrible stories, one of which a friend of his playing at Yorkshire, who wasn't informed that he had been sacked and found out in the local paper, you know, to find out that your career had
been... Oh, he was wrapping something up in his...
It was his fish and chips.
He came back with some fish and chips and then opened the fish and chips and saw from the back page.
And there was another quite interesting one of a wicketkeeper at the time, a Gould, I forget his first name, who was dismissed for naught and came back knowing that that was it, that that had been his chance to prove himself for a new contract, knowing that that was the end. And Hughes talks about his crestfallen face, his realisation that was it. And there is a real sort of brutality to this.
And certainly when you... because there's you see Mark Ramprakash first come onto the scene, you see Gus Fraser first come onto the scene. And these are the characters who have sort of characterised the last 20 years of English cricket. But actually, for Hughes, they're actually... they become very poignant reminders of actually how sort of short, this is going to sound incredibly morbid, but sort of how short the life of a cricketer is, you know, that chances come and go so, and it's actually only if you are a Ramprakash or a Fraser that the life, or a Gassing or a Brearley.
Perhaps Hughes' redeeming tendency again and again is the fact that he is very level-headed and very, very humble, and you get the expectation that you get the sense that for him, just the joy to be playing, he's never really expected perhaps anything more than that, and that kind of keeps him grounded. But you do sometimes ask the question, I mean, how much is he enjoying this?
Yep.
There seems to be so much pain involved, so much difficulty involved.
So Simon Hughes is a lot of hard yakka, lots of hilarious, side-splitting almost anecdotes, but a lot of pathos as well. So, to the debate, and as Australia travelled to South Africa for an unusually short tour, we ask whether there's anything to learn from a two-test series.
I think a test match series needs to be the ultimate challenge for any international cricketing side. It's effectively asking a team, can you sustain a high level of performance over as many as 25 days of cricket? And a two-test series just patently does not provide such a challenge. I mean, in terms of individual players, I'm not really sure two matches tells you anything about an individual player. You don't, for example, learn that much about a batsman in four innings. A test series should really see a batsman examined in all sorts of conditions, all sorts of situations, so you really get to get the feel for the type of player that he is. It's just not possible to have that sort of full examination in two tests. Finally, I don't think a two-test series can ever definitively prove who's the better side. There just hasn't been enough of a contest for you to say with total confidence. I reckon it's possible for a team to win a two-test series without you feeling that they've shown their superiority.
I would disagree on the question of needing to to test a player over 25 days, because actually I think players are under most pressure when they have one chance to shine. When you say to a player, this is the final day of an Ashes match, when you say to Kevin Peterson at the Oval in 2005, this is your moment, sir, you're not going to have another chance, you're not going to have four extra matches after this one in which to sort of catch yourself up, so you have to shine on this occasion. Sorry, Andy's having a little trouble with his microphone becoming too intimately tangled with his chair. So there's that one thing. I think the pressure of putting telling a player that they have to shine on one moment is very significant. What I also like about two test series, and I do have some caveats which I'll come on to in a second, but what I like about two test series is that there is never a dead rubber. And too often you see, and actually I think this comes from having grown up watching Ashes series in the 1990s, but too often you see 5-0, 4-1 victories. In a two-test series, there's everything to play for in the second test, which means that it keeps the game alive all the way through. And so, for that reason particularly, I think that I agree that this Australia-South Africa, or the South Africa-Australia series, should be longer, simply because I want to see them testing for longer. But I think that actually, in terms of keeping interest to the end of the series and keeping the series alive, a two-test series is the way to go.
Okay, I mean, I think this issue of a big player will perform on demand, they will perform in a game, I just think it doesn't take into account the fact that you can be an outstanding player, mm-hmm. and in a two-test series, you might get one dodgy decision, one ball that keeps low. You know, there is an element of chance.
Though.
There is an element of chance in cricket, and I think a five-test series sort of evens that out. Similarly, if you take into account the question of kind of form as well, you would hope over a proper test match series, over a proper five-test series, players will get the opportunity to play themselves into form if necessary.
But I don't. I just think it puts too much onus on the fact that people can try again. I do think that people should be able to, in a sense, you know, great performers can perform on demand. I mean, it's like saying that a bowler should be able to bowl as many balls as he wants, just to kind of try out without having any sort of punitive action against the fact that half of them will be smacked for six.
Your point about dead rubbers is right in that obviously a two-test series you don't, but then, I mean, I think we're sort of going down a dangerous line here. I mean, a one-test series, you're guaranteed no dead rubbers.
Of course, but I do. I mean, there are too many series where you have what we were talking the other day about the fact that Test cricket at the moment has sort of divided itself perhaps into three tiers, and series where you have people, teams in the first tier and teams in the third tier playing each other, and there's no sense of competition whatsoever. But in two Test series, it makes very sure that if it's England playing against New Zealand at the moment, say, in the Test series, you make very sure that England can never be certain until the last day of the series that they're actually going to win it and spare their blushes. And I just think it's a better way of balancing up those things.
I think where perhaps we might sort of agree on this is the fact that when you've got really good sides, or certainly a really appealing contest like the South Africa Australia, because I don't actually think this Australia is a great side, but I think it's a very appealing contest, two tests just seems too short.
No,
you know, it just seems like short. But I think where maybe it does seem perhaps more valid is, I don't know if we need to see Bangladesh West Indies over five tests.
But I think there's another point here, which is that actually you learn a lot about a team and about players from the way they approach matches which don't necessarily matter all that much. The way that they approach dead rubbers, the way that they approach short little two-test series, the way that they approach two-match one-day series, for instance. And actually, I think the sign of an excellent side, and the side that's got a very good mentality sometimes, is the fact that they would be able to be as competitive in those kind of games as they will when something sort of bigger is at stake. So you look at the Australian side of the late 90s and early 2000s, and they will, they made very sure that they won series 5-0 rather than 4-1. I mean, with that Australian
side, kept the pressure
up. There was an exception when Butcher scored that remarkable 150 in 2001. I think it was, but anyway, that's a complete aside. But I do think that there is something quite admirable about a side that can keep up that intensity when there isn't necessarily something to play
for. I just wonder that the ideal should be that grounds should have different sort of natures of their pitches, they should be different environments, and I think sadly that's often failed to be the case in recent times. Yep. And I think that's one thing a five test series can offer, that it, you know, within England, for example, can a visiting side deal with a seeming pitch at Headingley? Can they deal with a Turner at the Oval? Yep. You know, sadly, it hasn't always been the case in recent times. You've seen too many series where the pitches have frankly been batting tracks again and again, but
I agree absolutely that five test series do provide the ultimate sort of not only cricketing spectacle but cricketing test, but I certainly think that there is a place for two test series within that mix. As ever, thank you for listening. You can let us know what you think about anything we've said today over at on Twitter at Reverse Sweps, and join us next time where we will be looking at CLR James's seminal Beyond a Boundary, and he'll be taking us through the history of the bouncer with examples he'll post on YouTube of his own bowling, and we'll be seeing how Australia get on to left field.